science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
That sting never gets old, Ellen.
No, that's true. No, always raises a smile, lad.
Yeah, I use it sometimes when I use the same context. Obviously not about science, because, you know. But you
just
can use the
anything.
Same sentence and put whatever else you want up there. That works really well.
Yeah. No, it works for anything. Yeah.
So, Ellen, how are you? You're just talking about some exam shenanigans or something.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, no, we had the exam board meeting after this over on the North Shore, so I have to drive over there and sit for 3 hours. Oh, boy.
Literally, I think those are the three most boring words I've ever heard. Exam, board and meeting.
Oh, yes. Oh, you would not be wrong, Will. You would not be wrong.
So anyway, science. I'm bored. I don't get bored already. Science.
Science.
I talked to, because we had the news roundup this morning. I talked to Mikey Havoc this morning on his show about the fluoride thing.
Ah.
And that conversation ended quite quickly because he said he's not a big fan of the old fluoride.
Ooh, is he not?
So if you run us through the story.
Oh hell.
We can have a little chat about it.
I better watch out for him. Sheesh. So anyway, so if your listeners hasn't heard, last week, I think it was last Wednesday, in fact, the Supreme Court ruling came down that the South Taranaki District Council were allowed to put fluoride in their water. And they've been doing this since 2012, and there was an organisation who didn't really like this called New Health New Zealand, and so they took it to first the High Court, and they were rebuffed there, and then they took it to the Court of Appeal, and they were rebuffed there, but they were then allowed to take it to the Supreme Court, and so they took it to the Supreme Court, and the decision came down last Wednesday that they lost, basically, so fluoridation was allowed to continue.
Okay.
And that's a big thing, because the whole fluoride debate has been going on for a very, very, very long time. And as far as I can see, the people on both sides have particularly entrenched views, and you ain't going to change their views particularly. But in my entrenched opinion...
Hey, at least you're honest.
Well, okay, so a little anecdote here. So I got into the whole science communication thing because of one letter to the editor of a paper down in Dunedin. And the letter basically said that we shouldn't fluoridate our water supply because fluorine was in sarin, the nerve gas, and so we shouldn't do it because this stuff's in nerve gas. And this did unfortunately display a complete lack of knowledge of chemistry, full stop. So that got my hackles up, as you can well imagine.
Yeah, I can definitely see that happening, Ellen.
And so I wrote back and said, look, you know, yes, fluorine is in sarin. And we've got fluorine gas as well, which is another thing. And then we've got fluoride, and they're three totally different things. One's covalently bound, one is an element, and the other one is an ion. And basically, if you don't know the difference between those, then in my humble opinion, you can't really have a valid opinion on fluoridation.
No, that sounds fair enough.
You think so?
Yeah, well, that's just people, you know, they see, oh, the word starts the same way,
yes,
so it
yeah.
has to be the same thing.
Yeah.
I think it's just is it a little bit
my
more
question
complicated.
Following that, though,
you've always got one, Will.
Yeah, I always have a question.
Yeah, fire away.
Are there any scientists within, I don't know, any community, any science community that disagree with fluoridation?
Yes, yes, there
so
are.
So there is a group that disagree who do know what you're saying
and
they need to know.
They publish a journal called Fluoride, and I was, yeah. Now, again, you publish an academic journal, you think that you're going to be able to sort of trust whatever's in an academic journal, but this one is kind of a little bit one-sided, shall we say.
No, I think we've had that conversation before.
Yeah, very, very possibly. But I had the good or whatever fortune to actually go to one of their conferences, which was down in Dunedin. So this was sort of a worldwide conference on fluoride, and they had, ooh, I don't know, 20, 30 people there possibly. I know. And look, you know, if it was bad for you, we'd all be bloody keeling over by the bucketful, wouldn't we?
Well, because the whole thing about it is that it's good for your teeth. It's good for the cavities, or stopping cavities, obviously.
Yes.
But are there any known side effects?
The only known side effect, as far as I'm aware, is if you have too much of the stuff, you can then get fluorosis, which sort of manifests as sort of a mottling of your teeth or something. And you can accumulate it in your bones at very, very high concentrations, and that can lead to sort of problems with your bones later on in life, I believe. But the concentrations that it is used in New Zealand are well below those dangerous sort of concentrations. Mm. And, you know, one other thing that not a lot of people realise is that fluoride actually occurs naturally in a lot of the waters in New Zealand.
Because I was researching it just before, and it said that it occurs a lot in groundwater reservoirs, but so does arsenic. So, I'm not drawing parallels between the two, obviously, because they're just two chemicals.
Well, they're both naturally occurring.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Yes, I completely agree. And so 95% of the water in New Zealand, the sort of the groundwater and bore water and stuff, has got concentrations less than 56 parts per million. And so the natural concentration is enhanced in fluoridated water up to between 0.55 parts per million.
Yeah.
And it's up to about 0.7 to 1 part per million, which is the equivalent of a milligram per litre.
So you'd have to really chug a whole bunch if you really wanted to.
You surely would, yeah, yeah. And, you know, as I say, if it was really, really, you know, terrible for you, we would be keeling over. We'd, you know, because it is, it's ubiquitous. It is pretty much everywhere. The people who are against it seem to be against it from a point of view of this mass medication thing, and that you should have the right to opt out of this, that it shouldn't be sort of imposed on everybody, and it should be sort of an opt-in rather than an opt-out thing.
Yeah, that's the point I was going to raise.
Yeah.
A bit fair.
Okay, so let's do the same thing, let's say, then with vaccination, let's say, you know. So basically in Australia they're making it mandatory to vaccinate your kids, you know. And, you know, that's certainly a medication. And if you don't vaccinate your kids, then you don't have access to, I think, sort of funding from the government and stuff like that. You know, they're making it pretty sort of seemingly draconian. But, some people argue against vaccination, but, you know, the majority think that it's a good idea.
But that's a bit different, isn't it? Because we're talking, like, obviously vaccination is, like, bigger impacts in people's lives than fluoride.
Well, reading up on this, they say that going in for dental surgery or whatever is one of the three most common reasons that kids go to hospital, apparently, because things get truly that bad, which did surprise me.
Shouldn't you do more education and, I don't know, crazy idea, subsidised dental care in New Zealand?
Which it is at the moment, though. I mean, you know, all of your school stuff is free, isn't it?
Yeah, up until 18. It's free.
Yeah, so it's free. So, you know, there's no excuse for not going to the dentist, but, people just...
Yeah, I feel like most people I've talked to about the fluoride issue, the big problem is what you've just been discussing, which is whether you should have the choice to do that.
Yep.
But would it be viable to have that choice? I mean, if you had the choice, most people go, I need fluoride, or would they just go, it's not there anymore?
Okay, they kind of do have the choice, because if you don't want it, you can just get a water filter. Yes, it's going to come at some expense or whatever, but, you know, if you're that thing about it, then, you know, that is an option. But I think for the greater good, you know, I think it's a good thing. I can see the argument about the mass medication thing and the freedom of choice thing. What about things like water chlorination? You know, now that's not exactly medication, but it's certainly saving you from bugs and all sorts of things like that.
Mm.
So, you know, you don't really hear a lot. Well, you certainly don't hear anything about that, really, in comparison to the sort of the fluoridation of water, unless you live in Christchurch, where they had, before the earthquake, I think they had all of their natural artesian water, they had sort of nothing in it, and now they're having to chlorinate it, I believe, because the supply. Right. Yeah, I believe so. So, you know, we're not... Well, the people who are doing it are not out to bloody surreptitiously poison the population. And... this is one of those things where you've got to hopefully sort of take experts' advice and, you know, say that if the experts think it's good, then it probably is good, because there's no bloody hidden agendas here or anything like that. They're just trying to do the best for everybody.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I noticed just before the light on our studio phone going off, but I feel like if I pick that up, especially...
Let's not do this on air, because we'll be here all day.
Yeah, we do have to move on. But do remember that you can text us on 5395 if you do have opinions, and we'll maybe read them out later, or maybe not.
Well, you can't say that. People are not going to text. We will read
We definitely will. No.
Opinions or informed opinions?
Oh, just we're not just opinions. We
discriminating.
Don't
discriminate. Everyone.
Fair enough. If you know the difference between fluoride and fluorine, then yeah, where we go.
We don't have like a text filter. Has a little quiz on it when you. Anyway, second story of the day. We're talking about crows. Well, actually, they were talking about this morning as well. Apparently, on the breakfast show.
As well, they should, because part of the work was done by one of Auckland's lecturers here. So a guy by the name of Alex Taylor. And, they've been looking at the New Caledonian crow. And looking this up on the BBC website, I was amused to see something like, on a small South Pacific island, blah, 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 blah. New Caledonia is about one-fifth the size of Ireland. So, you know, if they call them that small, then yeah. But anyway, so what they're doing is kind of cool. So the New Caledonian crow is already known as a fairly intelligent bird. And... Mm-hmm. It can actually make tools with sticks, essentially. And they've got a wonderful video on the BBC website, actually, where this came from, where they will curl the end of sticks using their beak to make little hooks. Mm-hmm. And then they'll go and poke them into logs and stuff and get the grubs out of the logs by using these little hooked sticks, which is pretty bloody cool.
Yeah, that's really smart.
Yeah, very, very smart. So these researchers wanted to find out what made these crows so smart. And the interesting thing was that they didn't seem to sort of communicate with each other. So they weren't passing on this knowledge of how to make these sticks from one crow to another. So they were sort of wondering how they knew how to make these sticks and how to make them even better.
That's a fundamental aspect of human learning, is that we talk to each
absolutely.
Other.
Absolutely, yeah. So
interesting.
What they did, and this is a really nice experiment, was that they got this little sort of pseudo-vending machine, and or in fact, a number of these pseudo-vending machines, and some pieces of cardboard. And if the crow dropped the right size piece of cardboard into the vending machine, he'd get a treat. And so they sort of trained them up on that. And then what they would do is give them one big piece of card. And the crow then had to figure out how to... or had to remember, basically, what was the right size of card for a particular vending machine, you know? So you had multiple vending machines and you had these big pieces of cards. And the crows could remember which size piece of card operated which vending machine. And so they would, apparently with a 50% success rate, which is probably pretty good, they would know to be able to rip the card up into particular size pieces and be able to... get the treat. And you know that strikes me as quite
these are really wild impressive. Crows as well, aren't they?
Yes,
so
they were
brought into captivity for what, two days or
yes
something?
they only keep them there for a very short time,
because there's a lot of videos around, you know, like on YouTube, on the internet, of crows that are living in captivity that learn multiple steps to unlock whatever and those are super impressive, but those aren't wild crows.
And so they wanted to choose something that the crows wouldn't actually find in the wild, that they'd never have come in contact with in the wild. And so
it was completely new learning, basically.
So here's a new thing, figure it out yourself sort of thing. And they do, and you know, that's really, really cool. Really, really amazing. So so obviously they are thinking that the crows make some sort of mental template. And so they can sort of somehow sort of visualize or remember.
So it's all perception and memory rather than shared knowledge.
Yes, indeed, yeah, seemingly. So it's not sharing the knowledge, it's actually, you know, remembering things. And that's really, really cool. I'm sure all the psychologists and everybody will be having a field day with this. But, you know, fascinating stuff, really cool. And if you do want to see this online, it really is, they do have a wonderful little video of the crows actually doing this.
Cool.
It's really, really cool. So on the BBC website. So just do a Google for that. And, small island, New Caledonia. So, yeah.
Alan, do you know what a group of crows is called?
A murder.
Ah, oh, damn. I thought I was going to catch you out with that one.
Yeah, but there's a wonderful meme online where they have a picture of two crows and the thing says attempted murder. It's clever.
Didn't know you were a meme guy.
Alan is most definitely.
That doesn't actually surprise me.
Our last story for Dear Science today.
Indeed.
This one kind of freaked me out. I don't like warm weather. I really hate warm weather, and I hate warm nights. I hate, you know, like...
Okay, well, don't go to Oman then, obviously. Yes. So this is all about the hottest, coldest temperature ever.
Yeah, that's a good one to get your head around.
Like ever, like or ever, just in that space?
No,
that
like place? Like ever on wow. planet Earth.
Well, recorded.
Oh, no, fair point. So, so on June the 26th in Oman, it never got below a temperature of 42.6 degrees Celsius in a little town called Kiryat. And 42.6 degrees is a hotter temperature than New Zealand's hottest ever temperature, which was 42.4 degrees in Rangiora. So
it's still pretty warm. I didn't know we got that high.
I was going to say it's hell on earth, but yep. Well, also,
well, not wanting that. To blow my own trumpet or anything, but I did go to Oman last year, lucky enough to go there, and sort of drove just not too far away from this place, and it was 47 degrees when we were there during the day.
Oh my God. You didn't die, so that's good. No,
what is that like? I honestly, I've never heard someone talk about this. What is that like?
It's not bad. because, okay, so I spent a little time in the Midwest USA, and that is just humid like you would not believe.
Yeah.
It's hot and it's humid, and it's you walk outside and it is lit, like talking, you know, they talk about going into an oven. It is literally like going into an oven.
So like dry heat is actually fine. Like it yeah. feels pretty much the same past a certain point,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. So it was survivable. It wasn't ridiculously ridiculous, but I've, you know, felt far hotter in places like Singapore or the Midwest USA or somewhere wherever it's really, really humid. So I think that's kind of cool. But the interesting thing, sort of, so doing some more research into this, so the daytime temperature for that place, Kiryat, was 49.8 degrees that particular day. So that's getting up there. And so, of course, that sort of makes you look around, what's the hottest ever temperature? Which was 56.7 degrees in Death Valley in 1913.
What number, sorry?
56.7 degrees.
But how did anyone survive
that? Well, there are people who don't believe that number. And so if that does get revoked, then the hottest well-measured one is 54, which is also in Death Valley and in Kuwait, sort of in the last 10 years.
It's numbers like that make you realise that Death Valley is a very adequate name. It works out.
But the really, really interesting thing was, again, on this website, it's got all of the sort of temperature records for 2018. And so in New Zealand, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 high temperature records that have been set this year. The hottest ever temperatures. So in places like Haast, Invercargill, Dunedin Airport, Wanaka, Lauder, Ranfurly, Clyde, it got up to 37.6 degrees in Clyde. That's getting hot.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is kind of interesting. I wouldn't have thought that this year was, you know, particularly warm or anything like that. But
was that in, 2018?
Yeah, that's in 2018.
Oh, because I thought December was actually hotter than January, so I would have thought the records would have been the year before.
But, you know, good old Auckland, it's only ever got up to 33.1. That's the hottest it's ever been in Auckland. So Dunedin is hotter than Auckland. There you go.
You can state that as a fact.
Well, you know, I'm a Dunedin boy. You know, Dunedin, we get less rain than Auckland. They get less wind than Wellington and fewer frosts than Christchurch. There you go. Everyone moved to Dunedin.
Tips from Alan. If you want a warm place to live, go to Dunedin. Students, you'll love it.
You should work for the tourist information.
No, don't go to Dunedin. I'm just kidding.
You can lick the mould off your walls for food. Thanks, Alan. We'll finish up there.
Okay.
That was Dear Science.
Darren, what's all this nonsense? It's camping. I told you to only pack the essentials.
It is the essentials. Undies, baked beans, a modem, a router, sunscreen and 800 metres of Ethernet cabling.
The internet is modern essential. Don't settle for second best with yours. Get Orcon. Orcon's unlimited fibre plans start at just $84.95 a month. Or go crazy fast with the gigantic plan for just $99.95 a month. Visit Orcon at orcon.net.nz. Terms and conditions apply.
Were you at the gig on Friday?
What gig?
The Radical Maris Noise Collective. I never thought seven dudes playing saxophones would change my mind about capitalism, but hello.
That sounds
then 2 hours of Nightcore remixes of Every Time We Touch.
What even?
And a white guy did a rap about feelings. So beautiful.
What?
What? Stay in the loop with the 95BFM Entertainment Guide. Online and on air 7 days a week, 3 times a day. 10:20 a.m., 3 p.m. and 6:20 p.m. It's gigs and that.
Irirangi Pōhō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Last Tuesday, we saw the appointment of a new chairwoman of the Māori Language Commission. Professor Rawinia Higgins of Tūhoe descent is the woman entrusted with the continued development of te reo Māori in New Zealand, as well as Māori language legislation. Producer Jennifer Rose Tamati talked to Rawinia Higgins a few days ago about her recent appointment, asking what her appointment meant for her and what the future of te reo Māori looks like in our country.
I'm excited about the opportunity to be the chair of the commission and working alongside the board and the office to be able to give effect to the Māori language legislation.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's exciting.
Cool.
Overwhelming a little bit, but but still early days. So,
what is the role of Te Tauriwhiri Te Reo Māori in 2018 and onwards? What are you hoping is achieved?
So in the new legislation, it clearly articulates the role and function of Te Tauriwhiri, and that being to lead the coordination of the Mahi Krona, or the Crown's Māori Language Strategies. That's still, as I understand, in draft form. So we anxiously wait the release of the Mahi Krona to be able to see how we'll be able to give effect to objectives that are outlined on that strategy.
And you worked on that strategy, didn't you?
Not on this specifically. Right. I've had, through my previous role on the Te Mātāwai board, I suppose maybe just to take a step back, the new legislation is taking a new approach to Māori language revitalisation, in that it takes into account the role of Māori in Māori language revitalisation, and in this case that's governed by Te Mātāwai, and the creation of two strategies, one for Māori that focuses on micro-language planning. So Te Mātāwai, specifically their goal or vision is Kia U Kai Pua no Te Reo Māori, reinvesting in the creation of intergenerational language transmission amongst families.
Mm.
And the Crown's vision is Kia Mā Hora Hora Te Reo, which is to ensure that the language is easily accessible and visible everywhere in the country, so taking a more macro language planning approach.
I've noticed, at least here in Auckland, huge interest around enrolment in te reo courses. Obviously this is really positive, with people from many backgrounds interested in engaging with the language, but I have also heard conversations around people finding it difficult to access courses because of so much interest and some frustration and questioning around who should be entitled. There are also worries voiced around what it means to have a surge of te reo speakers who are not necessarily from a Māori background. I myself feel like a lot of whakamā and guilt when my knowledge is not to the level of someone else's. What do you think about these kind of conversations, and what does it mean for rangatiratanga of Māori culture and knowledge?
Okay, so let me try and take you back to the first question. I think that there is definitely a positive attitude towards the language in more recent times. And I think demand for language courses has certainly increased, and it has become a little bit difficult to access those courses, which again is a positive demand. I think the issues around entitlement to the language does challenge people from a rangatiratanga perspective.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think one of the things, particularly the research that myself and my colleague have done around understanding the value of te reo Māori. Te reo is one of those interesting languages that, unlike many other languages, it comes with a lot of layers of value.
Mm.
And in those layers of value, we can be positive or negative depending on which layer or filter we're putting through, whether intrinsic, so tied to our identity, all the way through to social, cultural, political, economic, educational, intellectual values that people place, and noticing a positive or negative reaction depending on which of those values you're applying at any one time. One of the things that, as a country, we are monolingual in attitude and behaviour, so we live in this kind of tension with the language. Intrinsically, it's tied to identity, and we have lots of aphorisms and sayings around he taonga te reo, my language is a treasure, reo rangatira, it's a chiefly language, and we talk about it being integral to our identity, but we still don't speak the language.
Yeah.
we're not using the language enough to kind of ensure that use is quite key. And then we shift along the kind of trajectory of positive through to negative, depending, again, on whether we see any benefit in it. So if we look at educational value, the numbers of kōhanga reo are quite large, but then as you go through the education system, the numbers in full immersion schools starts to dwindle, and then high schools the same. So whilst we have over 400 kōhanga reo, there was a time at its peak where there was over 800. And kura kaupapa and whare kura, there's about 72. So it's not like there's a huge spike in our pipeline of language growth amongst our own people. So I get the tension that we live in. My colleague and I, we used to call it, we have the Gollum effect with our language, where we talk about he tonga te reo, that's my precious, and we want to hold on to it and not let other people have the language or be entitled to the language more than others. But if we look at it from a youth perspective, part of getting other people to use the language helps to prompt others to see, oh, there is some value in this language and I might be more inclined to want to learn and want to speak. Because language trauma, for example, is a real thing.
Yeah.
So we inherit language trauma, even if we've never actually experienced it ourselves. And so our parents or grandparents who have had negative experiences that can transfer down generations. So I think in this new language landscape is around trying to turn that around and trying to make it more positive by kind of focusing on how do you restore language in homes through the work of Te Mata Wai, but also how does the language get positioned in society as being of value.
And I think that, yeah, on the other side of things, there is that the questioning of value and validity and normality. And one of my favourite academic conversations that I've been exposed to this year is from Linda Tuhiwai-Smith, where she says Māori identity, language and values are normal and valid, so you're not going to approach things in a way which questions the normality or validity. Unfortunately, I feel recently, at least in the mainstream media, so much of the conversation has been whether te reo is valuable or valid. How do we respond to conversations like this, and how do we move beyond this discussion?
I think one of the things that, you know, in terms of understanding the value of the language across the board, so from that big societal level, is te reo is everywhere. So you cannot avoid te reo Māori in this country. Place names are a defining feature of our country, and reminding people that it is this nation's first language. In that space is that positioning of where people come from, more likely than not, has a Māori name or has a whakapapa that connects them to that place. Whether that is actual genealogy in terms of Māori genealogy or whether they're successive generations of non-Māori who have been in that space, there's more than likely that they are coming across or connected to some form of te reo. Equally, you know, the defining feature at a global level of this country always falls to te reo, whether it's through the haka or through the national anthem, sung properly. But, you know, there was a time not so long ago where generations of New Zealand children today will not
bought a whole lot of frozen hash browns the other day because I'm a bad person and I ate hash browns.
The more we start normalising the language, the more people see that it's very much part of their identity as New Zealanders. For Māori themselves, you know, we will always have that intrinsic connection to the language because it's tied up in how we describe ourselves, whether it's through our pepeha, like your pepeha when you identified who you were for me, so I can automatically make a connection to this is where Jen is from. She's from Rotorua and she's from up north.
Yeah.
Without even having to ask the specifics. For me, that's enough to connect me to you and have an appreciation of your background without you having to say too many words. So in terms of language revitalisation, how do we take the kind of positive attitudes around identity markers, instill them in our own tamariki and mokopuna for future generations, that it becomes the norm for them, that the struggle for them is no longer the same struggle that it was 30 years ago. And I think we've moved past that. So if I think about pioneers like Linda Tui Waisumath, who was at the forefront of ensuring that our tamariki had access to language through koanga reo and karakaupapa when they were denied language themselves, now we need to see what can we do to shift the dial a little bit further in this new space, knowing that we have koanga, we have karakaupapa, we have wharekura, wānana. How do we continue to shift the dial so we become more bilingual and open to bilingual conversations and understanding what bilingualism actually means?
Where do you currently see real successes in Aotearoa, and what do you think are the most exciting things to come?
I think being able to work in a new policy landscape is